Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Brainwaves, hear the world differently. Bringing community mental health to you, raising awareness and challenging stigma. Tune in to 3CR Community Radio, Wednesdays at 5pm.
Melbourne's Drive Time Radio program, featuring community organisations, powerful stories and information. Find us at brainwaves.org.au. Proudly sponsored by Wellways Australia.
I would like to begin by paying my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I am coming to you from today. Land where at Brainwaves we tell our stories, and land where the traditional custodians have told their stories for many, many years before us, and continue to tell their stories. I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners who are listening today.
Just a warning, in today's show we'll be discussing suicide, so if this is confronting for you or distresses you, then please tune out.
Loneliness is something most of us will experience at some point in our lives. It can arise when we lack social connection, or even when the connections we do have feel shallow and meaningless. People from marginalised communities can be especially prone to loneliness. Many of us know that unique ache of longing for romantic connection, or that deep isolation following the loss of a loved one. And then there's existential loneliness, that unnerving sense of being disconnected from everyone and everything around us. In Australia, recent reports suggest that 1 in 5 older people and 2 in 5 young people are experiencing loneliness. This level of loneliness experienced by people today has even been labelled as epidemic. And loneliness doesn't just affect us emotionally. It has a serious consequence for our mental health and is responsible for a range of chronic illnesses. So today, we're joined once again by Nathan Bell to explore this regrettable part of the human experience and his new book, A Lonely Man. Nathan, welcome back to Brainwaves. It's lovely to have you with us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again.
So for any listeners who might not be familiar with you, could you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and share a bit about your background?
Oh, well, I'm 39 years old. I've been taking writing seriously for about 6 or 7 years, which began with my debut novel, Kings of the New Age. I live with bipolar schizoaffective disorder and autism. Sometimes I think I have magical powers, which is fun. I'm a mental health advocate. I've done public speaking around promoting consumer rights in the past in my 20s. That's a little bit about me.
And you've recently published a story called A Lonely Man. Can you tell us a bit about the story and what inspired you to write it?
Well, it's a very sad story, and it's not a story that that sugarcoats anything about life. It's a very gritty, real, raw story. And there's two main events which inspired me to write this story. When I moved into Newcastle about 12 years ago, I lived in a very old building with very cheap rent in a very small room. But the people in the building were mostly very old people who didn't have friends or family, didn't have a great social network, and young people in a similar position, people with substance abuse issues and mental health issues. And it was a specific occasion when I lived there that I found out that someone had died in their room alone, and it had taken quite a while for anyone to discover that they had passed, and the building noticeably smelt like the deceased. And so that was a shocking realisation in my life, where I realised, well, that's the reality for some people. That's how they live and that's how they die. Furthermore, a friend of mine showed me a song about exactly that. He played me a great folk song, which I can't recall the name of, about an old woman who dies alone in her apartment and nobody finds her. So I'm a man who believes in confronting the brutal reality of life. Life is brutal, and we have to practice love and compassion and empathy, which are all soft things. But the reality of the nature of the universe is it's a brutal system. It's not forgiving. It's not nice. So in my work, I try to confront the harsh realities of nature and loneliness and people dying alone. And these tragedies are the realities of nature for a lot of people. So
when we first meet the lonely man, David, in your story, he's in a pretty bleak place. He's living in an apartment block with aggressive, sometimes violent neighbours. His flat's cluttered with mouldy takeaway containers and he's physically dishevelled. He spends his morning watching television with a long neck of beer. What led him to this point in his life?
I suppose just probably being disappointed in the outcomes of his life. So David's from a pretty hard background. His mother's a heroin addict. So this one is not a fictional memoir. Some aspects of this book draw on my lived experience, and many of my books are fictional memoirs, but this one is not a fictional memoir. Much of this book is just fiction. My mother is not a heroin addict, but David's mother was a heroin addict, and he has lost his family around. He's lost his mother and the rest of his family, and his friends abandoned him in his early 20s because they could see that he was a problem drinker. He has schizophrenia as well, so he's been through bouts of mania and episodes of delusions and hallucinations, and he lives on welfare. And I suppose he's just a man who has lost hope for the future. He wanted all these big things. And this is what I really want to draw attention to with this story about David. You know, we see people in the street who we can see are clearly detached and are alone, people with substance abuse issues and mental health issues. And we think, well, I suppose we don't think much of who are they and what are they. But what I always remember is that all of those people once upon a time dreamt of being an actor or an astronaut or whatever it is that they dreamt of being. You know, everyone is a human being and everybody dreamt of those things. So some people, things just don't work out for. So things didn't really work out for David, and he ended up on welfare in a housing commission building, and he's not a happy man.
And pornography is a part of David's world. What role does it play in his life? And related to that, what role do sex workers play for David?
David has seen sex workers frequently, and that's one of his only means of seeking romantic experiences or sexual experiences. And that's the same for pornography. Those are his only avenues for pursuing sexual relations, because he hasn't found women who are interested in him. So he has not been fortunate enough to learn to engage in meaningful relationships. Now, that is very similar to me. I have had one adult partner in my life, and otherwise I've been single most of my adult life. I'm 39. I think a lot of that is because I've made unconventional choices in my life. Like, I've spent the last 20 years just immersed in producing content and investing money in content and producing videos and stuff. And I haven't given time to normal things like getting a stable job or completing a degree. So I think that's one of the reasons I've ended up by myself. I'm very much a singular entity, and I bop around and I do my own thing, and it's not very conventional. But David's not like that. David is just an isolated man with no direction, and he doesn't have any sort of activities that he does or any passion pursuits that he does. He likes to write poetry, but infrequently does it because he's lost touch with his artistic side, I suppose. So pornography and prostitutes play a big role in filling those gaps in his life which are present.
And David is also on a treatment order. He's required to take medication or risk being hospitalised again. But the medication doesn't seem to ease the deeper pain he feels from isolation and lack of love. Do you think the medical system sometimes puts too much emphasis on medication and not enough on emotional or social connection?
Well, this is a big thing I advocate for because I find it ridiculous, honestly, because a medication is one thing, and that's fine that people need medication because they experience mania or they hallucinate or become delusional, and that's all good and well. But I'll give, let's talk about antidepressants. You can take a lot of antidepressants and it will bring your mood up. It doesn't change the fact that the world's at war, that there are rapists and murders and murderers everywhere, that people are abusive and treat each other poorly. What does a pill do about this? So, it's good to give people antidepressants so they can get on a level playing field, feel good and go about their day and try and do something productive and functional. But always at the end of the day, we need as a society to fix bigger problems and then people will be happy. So I find the whole thing ridiculous personally. It's a personal thing that really bothers me that health weighs so heavily on medications because I find it denying of reality.
In fact, at one point, David feels that doctors mistook a genuine emotion he was having, anger, for mental illness. What do you think it's like for someone to have their real feelings dismissed or medicalized in that way?
Well, I've had that happen in my experience in the mental health system, and I find it very bizarre. I don't understand how anyone can think that way. We've come to this point where we're labeling. Now, we don't want people to be angry. We want people to be settled and respectful and not abusive. But if a person is very frustrated, if we dismiss that as a symptom of an illness, it invalidates things which are valid. A person may have very good reason to be frustrated. Their life may be terrible. So I find that concerning. And I think that's a concerning trend in our society to dismiss frustrated people expressing frustration as having a disorder. That bothers me immensely. I find that to be an abuse of that terminology.
And thoughts of suicide are never far from David's mind. What do those thoughts represent to David?
Well, to be clear on this matter, I've never been suicidal. Again, this is a fiction, this one, unlike many of my other books, which are fictional memoirs. This one is purely a fiction. So I'm not a suicidal individual, and I never have been. I've always wanted to kick butt in life. So what does suicide mean to David? I think it probably means an escape from the suffering he feels every day, an easy way out. He's a bit of a nihilist, so he understands that he will inevitably die anyway and doesn't see that there's any inherent meaning in the universe. So he sees it all as rather pointless. So I think it's just a way to escape having to survive each day through this life, which he considers to be quite miserable.
And yet there's a small but persistent sense of hope in David. Hope for a better future. That hope ultimately keeps him here. What does that hope consist of for him?
Oh, well, he must just have a strong spirit. I'm similar to this because things haven't worked out for me in my life. I've had some great tragedies happen in recent years, but I've always maintained hope. So many people don't maintain hope, and that's very sad. So what do we do about that? How do we, you talked about the medicalization of things. So I asked the question, how do we come up with a medical means to provide an individual with a sense of hope around their life? Because I think people who commit suicide must just, many of them probably have had genuinely very bad experiences and can't see any hope that things will improve. And I often think it's reality that for many people, circumstances don't improve. So that's also a part of the nature of how the universe works. It's random and things don't necessarily work out in any positive way. Yeah, he does have that hope. And you can see him clinging to that. He had big dreams when he was young. This is a man who thought he was going to be very successful when he was a teenager. He didn't anticipate to end up in this position. I can't explain to you where that hope comes from. I have that hope, even though things haven't worked out for me, and I've persisted through dark times, and David has that hope, and some individuals don't have that hope, and they complete suicide. So how do we create a medicine or a formula or some sort of method for giving people hope? And my personal belief is that meaningful activities give people purpose. So whether it's woodwork or working on cars or working on computers, whatever it is an individual enjoys doing, hobbies essentially, which is what we do where I attend at Reliability, the Creative Arts Service. We do arts programs. And I think that's how we give people, giving people activities gives them something to believe they're doing something, so they serve some purpose, and then they can take that further, and then they start to dream and they start to feel more positive. So I think that's the direction I would take it if I was making decisions in health.
On the day the story unfolds, David is scheduled to meet his NDIS worker for the first time. For listeners who may not be familiar, can you explain what the NDIS is and what an NDIS worker does?
Oh, but the NDIS was brought in to provide equity to people living with disability. So essentially NDIS funding is allocated to people with disability or mental illness, and that funding is then used to pay support workers their hourly rate so that they can provide care to the disabled person. And support workers can do a range of activities. It's pretty broad what support workers can do. Generally speaking, a lot of support workers tend to do help people get shopping or do paperwork or pay bills or go to doctor's appointments, or sometimes they take them out for some recreation, which is community engagement. If they don't get out in the community very much, a support worker can support them to get out in the community with moral support and to feel comfortable amongst people. That's what the NDIS is, and that's what a lot of NDIS support workers do. At the service I attend, we do creative arts support, which means we support people to learn skills in digital media and animation and drawing and painting and music and film and a whole range of different creative things. So it can be as broad as that as well. And I think those sorts of supports get a better result with getting people heading in a direction where they're going to achieve something and feel better about themselves. That's what the NDIS is, and that's what a support worker can do. It's very broad.
David's new NDIS worker, Steve, seems to gently expand that small sense of hope David already carries. In what way can support workers like Steve make a real difference in someone's life?
Well, for some people, it's just as simple as having a friend. I've had many friends in my life, but then I went through a period where I had a couple of friends and they stole from me, and then I cut everyone off. I've got the people at the Creative Arts Centre I go to, and they're my friends, even though it's a professional working environment. For some people, it's just as simple as having some company. And that's very important, because having some company and having someone to share conversations with can really do a lot for your mental and your physical health. And isolation actually damages your mental and physical health. Now, I can't quote the studies about that, but I'm aware that that has been shown. Isolation causes immense physical and mental stress, which has negative impacts on people's lives. Sometimes it's as simple as just having a friend to talk to and someone to spend time with. But support workers can also help in many other ways, in bringing a person up in their mood and helping them feel better about themselves and who they are.
And that said, David's also suspicious of Steve. He worries Steve might be reporting back to the hospital or even reading his thoughts. Where do you think that distrust comes from? And has that distrust played a role in David's isolation, perhaps making it harder for him to form close relationships with people?
Well, that's two things. That's paranoia, which is a symptom of schizophrenia, which is a very real medical symptom. And paranoia is often invalid and excessive. And I've lived with excessive paranoia on a number of occasions in my life. So that's one thing. But it's also experience. David sensed that Steve is reporting back to mental health on his drug use and his behaviour. That's experience as well, because People do this thing of reporting on each other and dobbing each other in, but you know, it's necessary, and there are mandatory reporters as well. But the point is, David is used to people doing what he feels as conspiring against him, because those things do actually happen in the world, and people do behave those ways, and it's a very touchy subject to discuss, and it all boils down to autonomy and how much autonomy a person should have and when we should intervene in a person's life. So David has had the government mental health workers intervene in his life in the past because of his drug use and his psychotic state. So he's very aware that, and he's on a court order, so he's expected to follow certain standards of behaviour, or his court order will be enacted and he will be scheduled into the psychiatric ward. So David's very aware that he does have to be on his best behaviour and do things by the court order, or Steve or any of the other mandatory reporters around him may very well take that back to mental health. So it's paranoia because Steve isn't there just on this agenda of spying on David, but it's also reality because, you know, this man is under a court order and he is being monitored to some extent around his behaviour and his choices. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm. Yeah. So throughout the story, David is acutely aware of the suffering and violence in the world. But in Steve's company, his NDIS worker, that suffering feels less overwhelming. Why do you think pain feels more bearable when we're not facing it alone?
Oh, that's a hard question. Well, I think, you know, if you look in nature, animals stick together, and we are animals and we stick together. There's very few solitary animals. So something in nature says that we're a communal species. We stick together in groups and we socialise to a degree, and different animals have different levels of socialising. So it's a part of our nature to seek connection with other beings, and we also seek connection with animals as well, and they seek connection with us. So there's something very deep in our DNA, I suppose, where things always feel better when we're doing it with someone else, and when we're a community, it's the nature of things, I think. So I hope that answers your question.
Definitely, I think that was a wonderful answer. David's also deeply affected by the fact that his music career never took off. There's a moment where he watches a successful rock star being interviewed on a morning show and reacts with bitterness. Why does that moment hit him so hard?
Oh, because he really wanted that, and he very much wanted it. And this part very much is based on me, because I don't feel this way anymore, because now I actually am getting quite a bit of success with my artistic ventures after many years of working on it. But I've gone through phases where I've been very bitter and angry because I've done numerous projects over the years and they haven't worked out. I've had to cast them aside, and I've invested money and time and effort. So I've definitely felt this way where I've been bitter that the dreams didn't work out. And I think there's, you know, people don't like to talk about it, but I think a lot of people would say, if they were honest, that they were very disappointed that they didn't get to live that dream life that they thought about when they were younger. So David definitely feels this way, because that was how he saw himself growing up. And as a teenager, he thought that was where it was going to go, and he likes his music. He likes to play his punk rock songs. He had all these fantasies about doing these big tours and shows, and now he's just an alcoholic man in an apartment in Newcastle. So he's devastated that was the expectation he set, and he never got anywhere near it. So,
as a teenager, David imagined success as fame, wealth, and famous friends. He dreamed of opening a gallery and a cafe funded by his rock star earnings. Is that a misguided definition of success? And could holding on to that definition be shaping David's emotions, motivation, and even his ability to connect with others?
Is it a misguided definition of success? Yes and no. I think a definition of success is going to be subjective to the individual. I think for me personally, deeper things would be the ultimate success. I want to be this big star artist, but I also want to push very powerful and considered narratives on the world, and that's just something I like to do. I'm very focused on affecting change in the world where I can, and I've always seen myself as ending up as a bit of a Peter Garrett, Midnight Oil, Start the Revolution rock star. So that's how I feel about it, being an artist who's worked hard for 20 years to try and succeed. So do I see it as a misguided understanding of success to aspire to fame and success? No, I don't think we have to say that it's bad to aspire to those things. Those are enjoyable things. And if you get to live that life, I think you're going to have quite a bit of fun. For me, it would be about the process of making the art. Say I was a famous actor, I wouldn't be so preoccupied with the fame. I'd be more interested in watching the movie after we made it and the process involved in making the movie. Was he just obsessed with fame and meeting women and having people praise him with accolades, or did he have some political conscience or some narrative he felt compelled to present to the world? I think it's a bit more just about the fame for him. It's not for me, but this is one of the areas this character draws on my mentality. And is this reinforcing his sadness? I think it is. I think it certainly is. As we've said, those failed dreams and those unrealized goals definitely do reinforce his sense of negativity. But do I think it is a misguided... And I think it's okay to pursue that sort of success if that's what you want. I think what a person calls success is subjective, and ultimately the individual decides what type of life they want to live. And if a person is really driven just to live a life as a famous rock star, I don't see anything wrong with that. It's harmless. It's not. There's a lot worse things you could be aspire to be than a famous rock star.
And throughout the book, David often focuses on women's physical appearances as he sort of comes into contact with people, and he measures himself against what he sees as beauty. Is he overly preoccupied with the physical attributes?
I think he's certainly.
Yeah, and also why do you think this character tends to overlook, you know, other things about, you know, people that he finds attractive, like personality, interests and other inequalities when he sort of feels desire?
Well, I think anyone walking down the street who sees someone they find attractive, finds them attractive. There's nothing wrong with finding people physically attractive. David doesn't have a lot to do with anyone, really. So he doesn't get the opportunity too much to explore any deeper attributes of a person's character or personality. Probably if he had more to do with people, you'd probably be looking a bit deeper into who they are as a person, but he is a very isolated man. So he's, you know, he's very socially poor skilled. He has poor social skills, so he's not engaging well with people who he does meet, and he doesn't have many opportunities to meet people and to go further into their personality. So I think he's largely left with what he sees immediately in front of him walking down the street. And I also think that naturally his eyes are drawn to physically attractive people too, because that's a very instinctual thing to be drawn to, physically attractive people. So he's, as anyone else is drawn to that. And he doesn't get the chance to go any deeper than that with anyone because he's so isolated.
Mm. And as the story progresses, cautious optimism begins to emerge inside David. It feels dangerous to him almost. I imagine some of our listeners might relate to that feeling of being afraid to hope in case it gets taken away. What would you say to someone who feels that some, you know, that same guardedness about letting hope in?
Oh, I think it's so hard sometimes. I've always maintained a strong hope. And that's why I keep producing content and pumping out stuff, and I'm so gung-ho. So I'm different to David in this sense as well, because I've always had a strong sense of hope and belief in moving forward and things will work out. I'm convinced things will work out, always have been. So David's hesitant to engage with hope. What would I say to someone like that? I think it's so hard. I've tried to say, have hope to people in the past, and people just aren't in the psychological state of mind to hear it. I think you have to be very slow. And this is what's wrong with our society when we engage with people who've been isolated from the community, because people like David who've been isolated from the community really need people to go in and be gentle with them and patient and slowly show. It's like finding a stray cat that's been beat up and it comes to your back door, but it won't come in the house and it won't let you touch you. It won't let you touch it. It's scared of people, and you want to welcome this stray cat in. You've got to be very slow and patient and show it, because people lose trust as they go through abusive styles of life and they get taken advantage of and they get rejected and exploited. They lose trust in people. So a lot of it is about trust. So you have to show people like David that you can be trusted and that they can trust you to be genuine with them. I hope that answer made sense.
I guess finally, where can listeners find A Lonely Man so they can read it and perhaps learn about other stories that you've written over the years?
Lonely Man is available on Amazon Publishing as both an ebook and a physical copy, which will be posted out to you. So you can Google author Nathan Bell, Newcastle, Australia, whatever combination of that you want, and it should come up.
Thanks, Nathan, for joining us at Brainwaves again. As always, it's a pleasure to learn from your insights, and I hope our listeners enjoyed hearing about you as well. You can find more of our shows on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au or wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to send us feedback or suggestions for shows via email at brainwaves@wellways.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next Wednesday at 5 p.m. for another episode of Brainwaves on 3CR.
If any of the things we have talked about today have distressed you, you can contact Lifeline on 13 1114 or Listen Well Warm Line on 1300 111 500.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.